This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Lester Brown, founder of the Earth Policy and World Watch Institutes. Lester has been honored with numerous awards, including a MacArthur Fellowship, the United Nations Environment Prize, and 25 honorary degrees. His writings include 51 books published in 42 languages. He has helped us understand the interconnections among such issues as overpopulation, water shortages, and climate change, and their effect on food security. Lester Brown is here today to tell us about his most recent book, a memoir titled Breaking New Ground, A Personal History, published in 2013. Welcome, Lester.
My pleasure, Diane.
What led you to write your book, Breaking New Ground?
A lot of pressure. The idea first came up with my publisher, W.W. Norton. They've published all the books I've done over the last 50 years or so. So they started suggesting it for a while, and others would bring it up. And then my longtime friend in the media world, Georgianne Geyer, who's a syndicated columnist, said, you know, you should do your autobiography because it will not only help people know what you think, but perhaps more importantly, why you think as you do. And that sort of was a new point that no one had made explicitly before. So I began to weaken a bit on the issue and then talk with Norton about it, and they were ready to go. So we have an autobiography now. I would say that writing an autobiography is sort of an exercise in self-psychoanalysis. You have to ask questions like, who am I? What were the conditions that shaped me? Who were the people that influenced my evolution as a person? So anyhow, it's kind of a fun thing to do, but you only want to do it once.
How would you describe your early life?
It was agrarian, for sure. Living on a farm, growing up on a farm. This is back when there wasn't a lot of mechanization. When Pop started farming in 1934, he bought a team of horses and a plow and some harrows and things and rented a farm and started farming. So we were dirt farmers, the real thing. And at that point, with relatively little mechanization, there was a lot to do by hand, from milking cows to, when we're growing tomatoes, literally walking the field and picking the color out of potato beetles off the tomatoes to keep them from being defoliated. So it was an interesting and, I think, invaluable situation to grow up in, because in growing up on a farm and being involved, and then, as my younger brother and I did, also starting our own tomato growing operation, you really learn a lot. I mean, it's an education unto itself. So in addition to that, of course, I was going to school throughout this period, but I think those of us who had the opportunity to grow up on farms were really among the lucky ones.
You have applied a systemic, holistic approach to addressing world problems. What experiences in your life led you to this approach?
Well, the interesting thing about the world today is that the more education you get, the more narrow the focus becomes, until by the time you're doing a PhD dissertation, it's usually just a very narrow topic, almost regardless of the field. My interest always has been to do the big picture, to look at things systemically, and that is, I think, partly the product, again, of being a farmer, because farmers can't be specialists. They can't be plant pathologists or entomologists or hydrologists or soil scientists. They have to deal with issues across the board and make decisions every day based on their understanding of those issues. So being a farmer, growing up on a farm, almost automatically makes you a systemic thinker. Or on another track from the conventional educational system, which over time keeps narrowing your field of study.
What was your educational background and how did it influence your later work?
Well, I went to rural elementary school in southern New Jersey. That was kindergarten through eighth grade. And it was not a large school, but not the smallest school ever. It was a three-room school. And New Jersey has a pretty good educational system, and I've always thought that I got a pretty good education in this system. And then for high school, went to the regional high school. the nearest town, which was Bridgeton, was 10 miles from the farm. And we had the combination of students who lived in the town of Bridgeton and students who lived in the farming region surrounding Bridgeton, all in the same high school. And so we rode buses every day from the farm to get to high school. And one of the things that distinguished our high school at that time was there were a lot of other ethnic groups brought in. There were Japanese who had been detained in camps on the West Coast who were given a chance to leave camps and work if they would come to the eastern United States. So we had a group of Japanese sort of introduced into our community. We had displaced persons from Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania. And then, not in school, but beginning about, I think it was early 1943, we had 600 German prisoners of war living in our community. They had been captured when Rommel surrendered his army in the North Africa campaign early in the war. The 250,000 troops that he surrendered were given a choice between staying in detention camps in the desert or coming to the U.S. to work. And I think a lot of them opted to come to the U.S. And so I think I was 9 years old at the time, and I discovered the Germans in the community when we took our tomatoes to the local can house and were handing the baskets of tomatoes off to the can house employees, and they were wearing khaki jumpsuits with PW stencils on the back in black. And that's when I discovered that these were German troops who had surrendered. So it led to a very sort of ethnically diverse, and we had the other, you know, usual ethnic breakdown that you find in this country, and also a substantial number of members of our class and community were of Native American descent, because the Lenni Lenape Indians in southern New Jersey did not leave and move west to get away from the Europeans. They remained on the land in their communities, so we had an integrated community of European migrants with Native Americans.
And would you comment on your further education as well?
In high school, I majored in agricultural science. In fact, they had two agricultural science majors, and I was in the college prep one, which meant you took a lot more science courses. And then on to Rutgers to study agricultural science, because I was farming. My brother and I had started our tomato growing operation. So studying agricultural science seemed to be the right way to go. And while at Rutgers, I took 24 science courses in 19 fields. I felt like a kid in a candy shop with all these science courses. Took courses in entomology, meteorology, geology, plant pathology, soil physics. It was just a phenomenal situation in terms of getting an education. And then after graduating from Rutgers in 1955 and growing tomatoes for another 3 years, I decided that just growing more tomatoes, and by 1958 we were marketing 1.5 million pounds of tomatoes a year, but just growing more and more tomatoes for the next 40 years didn't seem all that challenging then. It also happened that in 1956, I spent the last half of the year living in villages in India under the International Farm Youth Exchange Program. This was run by the National 4-H Club Foundation. So that exposure to agriculture in India, actually living with Indian village families, was also at this point influencing my thinking. So I decided I wanted to join the Foreign Agricultural Service of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And to do that, you had to have a degree in agricultural economics, because your principal responsibility in the Foreign Agricultural Service, serving overseas as an agricultural attaché, was to sell U.S. corn, soybeans, wheat, and cotton. So you needed a degree in agricultural economics. So I got that degree and joined the Foreign Agricultural Service of the U.S. Department of Agriculture on June 1st, 1959. And I was assigned the Rice Bowl countries in the Asia branch. So that began my career there. And then after a couple of years in USDA, I decided to go to Harvard to get a master's in public administration, what was then the Litauer School, now called the Kennedy School of Government. So that was it for formal education. three college degrees, the Bachelor of Science in Agriculture, then Ag Econ, and then Public Policy.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Lester Brown, founder of the World Watch and Earth Policy Institutes and author of the book Breaking New Ground, A Personal History. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you speak about your experience in India and how it influenced your thinking about world food and population problems?
Well, at the time, I lived in villages in India. The population of the country was something like 440 million. And I remember thinking at the time of how crowded it was in India. Well, today India has 1.2 billion people, or nearly three times as many. But coming from the United States, we only had 150 million in this country at the time. It seemed crowded to me in India. But the chance to live with Indian families in the villages and become a working member of the farm family was just a great experience, and in getting to know people in a very different culture, speaking a different language, and that contributed a lot to my education and the way I saw and thought about things. And it undoubtedly was a factor that led me to join the Foreign Agricultural Service of the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
How did World Watch Institute get started?
I was in the Department of Agriculture from 1959 to 69, but in January of 1969, Richard Nixon became president, and I was already an agency head in the Department of Agriculture. I think I may have been the youngest agency head in government, but I did not want to work for Richard Nixon, so I resigned my position and helped the late Jim Grant start the Overseas Development Council, which was a small think tank focusing on the problems of developing countries and the U.S. role and relationship in helping those countries develop. So that opened up a whole new world for me of being able to work on a wide range of issues. And I produced about a book a year while I was there on food, on population, on the growing interdependence among countries. The book on that subject was entitled World Without Borders. It was published by Random House and got a lot of attention because it was one of the first books to recognize that the world was becoming more and more integrated economically, socially, politically, environmentally, and I tried to capture that in this book, and it turned out to be a rather successful book.
And so specifically, what led to World Watch Institute getting started?
Well, in the early 70s, I began to sense a need for a research institute to work on global environmental problems. Up until that point, the only environmental research was in sort of a subsection of existing research institutes that were looking at international affairs or economic development or what have you. But environmental issues were kind of hidden away, tucked away in the corner of those larger organizations. And it seemed to me that environmental trends would be shaping our future in a way that people did not realize. And so I was on an advisory committee of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund to help them make the transition from the so-called Brothers Generation to the Cousins Generation. And I had recommended that one of the things they might want to support would be sort of an environmental report card for the Earth, where they would have someone take a look at the Earth and do it on an annual basis and sort of track the changes in the Earth, whether it was deforestation or overfishing or overplowing, whatever, to sort of keep track of the Earth's health. And they liked the idea, so they decided to do it, and then they came back to me to do it. And I declined once, and it was Bill Deedle, who I think was the vice president of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, who contacted me. He came back a second time, and again I declined. But then the third time he came, and I finally decided to give it a try. So that's how the State of the World report was born in 1984. And what happened was that it seemed to be the right report at the right time, and it just sort of took off. And within a few years, the first printing was 100,000 copies, and it was eventually translated into, I think, 31 languages. So it just found a place not only in the U.S., but worldwide. So it appeared in every major language, from English to Arabic and Japanese to Russian to Portuguese, Spanish. It was being published in virtually every major language. So that really enhanced the role and the contribution of the State of the World Report. And over time, because the UN did not do a State of the Environment report, WHO did a State of the World's Health, FAO did State of the World's Food and Agriculture, the International Labor Organization of the UN did an annual report on labor trends and conditions, but no one was doing environment. So when we launched the State of the World report, we had the field pretty much to our own. And what happened then was, because there was only one State of the Environment report, it was being used not only by the general public and by professors and environmental activists and so forth, but it was also being used by governments in other countries because it was the only State of the Environment report that was available. So that was sort of an unexpectedly successful initiative, and it is still being published today.
What public policy steps have been taken by governments in response to World Watch papers and our books? What are some examples?
One of the most interesting was the very first World Watch paper we did, which was done by Eric Ekholm, who had been my research assistant when we started World Watch. And it was entitled The Other Energy Crisis, Firewood. Now, this was being published at a time when the Saudis had imposed an oil export embargo and the price of oil had quadrupled between, say, 1972 and 74. So there was a lot of interest in and attention being paid to oil. And so we recognized that for a third of humanity, it was the firewood supply that was the real energy issue, not oil. So in entitling the paper, The Other Energy Crisis, Firewood, we sort of caught a wave, and it altered the forestry program at the World Bank. Once they had read it, they realized that they had to rethink things. And individual countries also redid their forestry programs, Indonesia, for example. So one of our goals was to produce reports that would be of interest to the public and to policymakers and that could be used by policymakers, and this was a rather dramatic example of that.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Lester Brown, founder of the World Watch and Earth Policy Institutes and author of the book Breaking New Ground, A Personal History. What led to Earth Policy Institute being founded?
After having been the founder president of the World Watch Institute for 26 years, I was beginning to think about my long-term future. I was already past retirement age in 2000, and so I ended up creating a new, much smaller organization that really gives me a place to work with a strong support staff. We have a total staff of 8 people, 5 of us who are doing research, including me. So it's quite small. For me, it's an ideal place to do research and write on global environmental issues, broadly defined.
What do you consider the most important contribution of the Earth Policy Institute so far?
Probably the development of Plan B, and we've done 3 or 4 books in the Plan B series. Plan B is the alternative to Plan A, which is business as usual. And we know that business as usual is not a viable option. So what we wanted to do was to give a sense of what an environmentally sustainable economy would look like, and then how to get from here to there. We know, for example, that it would have to have a stable population. We couldn't have a population increasing forever. We knew we'd have to restructure the energy economy, because if we continue with our fossil fuel-based energy economy, we'll be toast, quite literally, with climate change. So we designed an alternative energy economy, one that was powered largely by wind and solar energy. And it turns out that this is all doable. And indeed, the world is moving now away from fossil fuels toward wind and solar energy. And that movement has begun to accelerate in a major way. China, for example, is building 7 huge wind mega complexes, the largest of which will produce enough electricity to satisfy the needs of a country like Poland. I mean, we've never seen energy development on this scale before with fossil fuels, but it's very exciting to see. And now we're also beginning to see very rapid growth in the installation of rooftop solar collectors to provide electricity for household use. And this is also going to, in the next year or two, just sort of explode in this country because the cost has come down so far, and also because utilities are going to find themselves in a difficult situation, because as more and more homes install rooftop solar cells, they'll be producing their own electricity. And because the utilities market will be shrinking, while they have to maintain the same infrastructure, they will have to raise their costs. So the combination of declining cost of rooftop solar installations and rising costs of utility supplied electricity will make this go much faster than I think most of us can even imagine right now.
What approaches to communicating your work have you found to be most effective to make the most difference?
Well, if you're trying to reach a global audience, a global constituency, you're sort of forced into doing books, because with books, there is a network of publishers around the world in all the major languages. But book publishing is the only segment of the information sector where this happens. Magazines don't get translated. If you do an article in the magazine, chances are it'll never be translated into any other language. So you're sort of forced to do books because in the world publishing industry, that translation role is built into the system. The other thing that is also good for reaching a global constituency is radio, and that includes the BBC World Service, where on a good day, if you're being interviewed, you may reach 20 million people, and that is broadcast hour by hour around the world. Another one is Voice of America, which also has a huge global audience. And I should mention CNN on the TV front, because CNN now more or less blankets the world. You can find TV sets even in remote villages in the developing world. So these are the things you have to think about in terms of disseminating information and reaching a global audience. One is the importance of books in that, and the other is to take advantage of the global electronic outlets like the BBC, Voice of America, and CNN.
Overall, what do you see as most hopeful in reversing the trends that are undermining our future? You've mentioned progress in the energy sector, but what else?
Well, with energy, the most exciting thing that's happening right now is coal-fired power plants are being closed in the United States. I think the week before last, the Sierra Club celebrated the closing of the 150th coal plant in the U.S. We still have 460 yet to go, but their goal is to close every one. And that will play a major role in reducing carbon emissions. So that's one of the most exciting things happening in the world today. Another exciting thing in the energy economy is what the Chinese are doing with wind energy. They have planned and have under construction 7 vast wind mega complexes, each of which will have a generating capacity of at least 20,000 megawatts. Think 20 nuclear power plants. These are huge wind farms. We've not seen thinking in the energy sector on this scale before.
Do you see progress in the population area?
We're not making nearly as much progress in the population area as we should. In the last couple of decades, the issue seems to have fallen off the table. Almost no one talks about it. You've probably never heard President Obama even mention the word population, even though he talks about international issues and poverty and development and these sorts of things. But we are projected to add 2 billion people. They will be added in two places, primarily the Indian subcontinent and sub-Saharan Africa. And I just don't think that the social systems in those two countries or subcontinents can withstand the addition of most of these 2 billion people. So that, I think, is going to be a real challenge for us. We need to make sure that women everywhere have access to reproductive health care and family planning services. There are literally millions of women in the world today, I should say hundreds of millions of women, who want to plan their families but do not have access to family planning services. We need to fill that gap. It costs only a few billion dollars to do it per year. It doesn't cost very much. The benefits, however, would be huge, because if you can accelerate the shift to smaller families, then it becomes much easier to help people escape poverty. It's difficult to do with large families. It's much easier with small families.
What do you consider your most important legacy?
Oh, gosh. Probably thinking broadly, the global approach I take to issues and everything I write, including the State of the World reports that I did for 26 years or the Plan B books I've done more recently, all are written for a global audience, a global readership. And two things, using a systemic approach to issues, not a specialized narrow one, but a broad systemic approach, and designing an information dissemination system that would get that information to people throughout the world. These are probably the two things that I would like engraved on my tombstone.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
That we need an enormous amount of change in a short period of time, that we can all play a role, and I would recommend picking an issue that's important to you, to the individual, and finding some friends who share that interest, and then going to work on it, whether it's closing coal-fired power plants or expanding funding for international family planning programs. These happen to be two of the biggest issues that we in the world are facing today. So I would pick one of those and get some friends to work on it and begin lobbying and writing letters and meeting with congressmen and even writing President Obama on these issues. They do go through the mail, and they are sensitive to what people are concerned about.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Lester.
Diana, thank you for a delightful interview. I've enjoyed it thoroughly.
You were just listening to Lester Brown, founder of the World Watch and Earth Policy Institutes and author of the book Breaking New Ground, A Personal History, published in 2013 by W.W. Norton & Company. For more information, check on the web at earth-policy.org. Lester Brown will speak about his book, Breaking New Ground, at Town Hall Seattle this coming Monday, November 11th from 7:30 to 9 p.m. Again, Town Hall Seattle, Monday, November 11th from 7:30 to 9 p.m. And the Town Hall website is townhallseattle.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on demand, and then podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on listener-powered 90.3 FM and kexp.org.